Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. This is a summary and analysis of Busting Myths About the State and the Libertarian Alternative by Zach Roefer. He begins with myth number one, the state is good and does good. Before we start criticizing anything, you'll want to make sure you're talking about the same thing, so you should really define your terms. If people think that the state is a vehicle, sort of like a tool, like a wrench or a hammer, just a mechanism to achieve something, well, you're probably not going to end up at the same place as far as your understanding of what the state should do or whether or not it should exist if you're not even talking about the same thing. So, the state maybe is a group of people that provide rules and roads and schools for society. Well, certainly country clubs and supermarkets provide goods and services and rules and ways for us to cooperate and are mechanisms for us to achieve our ends in life. Does that make roads and schools and supermarkets and country clubs and religious organizations government? Well, no, not necessarily. Roefer gets to the heart of what the state is right at the beginning and says the state is violence, not a vehicle. So what makes government or the state a unique organization in society is it claims a right no other organization has, the right to initiate aggression or violence against peaceful people by decree, by making laws or legislation. So the state has the right to do that against the citizenry. If the citizenry tries to do it against the state, they're called literal terrorists. They are initiating violence for political ends against politicians. So here we finally have a principled difference between the state, society, and a general organization. Roefer defines taxation as the confiscation of property of peacefully acting individuals. If taxation were just a morally just way of acquiring money or property, well then certainly any organization would just have the right to issue taxes against peaceful people. So also, instead of me having to vote for a congressman to tax on my behalf, if they represent me, I certainly would have the right to issue taxes against peaceful people. So if I don't have the right to issue taxes against citizens, how can I delegate that right to a congressman? Vitally important step that many people think past. He says, regulatory legislation is passed to force peacefully acting individuals to take or refrain from taking actions with their bodies or private property contrary to how they would otherwise act. Imagine me saying to a fellow podcaster, I am a very nice man here to represent you, and I am going to regulate your podcast. And by that I mean, before you are allowed to issue a podcast to people and spread your ideas to the world, you just have to run everything by me. So make the podcast, send it to me. I will see if it's okay and up to my standards, because we have to have standards, and I'll tell you whether or not you are allowed to publish it. Well, this, first of all, is me being a tyrant. Second of all, it would drastically decrease the amount of choices and opportunities the average person had to access podcasts that they want. Also, I'm totally biased, as is every other human being, and all government officials, because they too are human beings. So, the regulatory idea is both immoral and economically unjustified. Roefer says, if government isn't coercive, how do you explain the violent penalties for non-compliance? Imagine me saying, you owe it to the Christian church to pay 5% annually of your income to the church. It's because of the church we have ideas like thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. You benefit from Christian ideology and Jewish ideology from the Old Testament. So since you benefit, therefore, the church and the temples have the right to take 5% of your income annually. And if you don't chip in, then, well, they have the right to put you in a cage. And if you resist the cage, well, they shoot you if you resist. That's what government does. You can see it's unjust because if any other organization tried to do it, you would blatantly see it as unjust. Just hold the state to the same standards you would hold any other organization. The root of the idea of libertarianism that Rofer is getting at is essentially an actual my body, my choice philosophy. I came across this meme. A license for registration is just a permission slip by the state you have to pay money for. Voluntary transactions between consenting individuals don't need third-party validation. Free people don't ask for permission and don't need legal validation. Imagine before you do anything, you say, gosh, I really wonder if a group of people in Washington, D.C. called the Congress Group approve of this. Why would you ever seek their advice on anything? Rofer then discusses entrepreneurial activity. I thought this was an excellent passage. I'm going to read the short couple pages here. As noted above, the purpose of an economy is to allocate productive resources, natural resources, labor, and capital goods, to maximize the satisfaction of human wants. No one can produce all of his own needs, and thus humans must trade. A person produces what he can and trades this product with others who are producing what he wants but cannot produce for himself. However, productive resources are scarce relative to human wants. Thus, choices have to be made in organizing these scarce resources to try to satisfy those wants that are ranked most highly by each person. The key question is, how can we know which wants are ranked most highly so that we could then try to organize resources accordingly? Those who organize these scarce resources are society's entrepreneurs. Their function is to try to anticipate human wants, bid for and organize the necessary scarce resources to create goods to satisfy those wants, and then price these goods appropriately and deliver them to consumers. Those entrepreneurs who are able to successfully bid for and organize resources at a lower cost than what customers are voluntarily willing to pay for, the end product would make a profit. The entrepreneurs who are unsuccessful at this task would incur a loss. The key point, however, is that entrepreneurs cannot force their products on consumers. In the free market, the customer is king, and he votes with his dollars every minute of every day. Those entrepreneurs who make profits would be able to purchase further resources, and those who incur losses would have to yield resources, both of which are beneficial for society, as it means resources are flowing to those entrepreneurs who are best at satisfying actual wants. Since society is more prosperous, the more human wants are satisfied. Profits are not something we should disdain, but rather something we should embrace. The lure of making profits is what draws entrepreneurs to take risk with their capital and time to try to find a way to satisfy customers, and losses are a way to discipline entrepreneurs who make mistakes in the process. Final point on entrepreneurs. An entrepreneur's task is very difficult. The knowledge of which his customers want in terms of price, quality, location, etc. is not available in any central database. And there are millions of customers in the economy, each with his own specific wants. Entrepreneurs therefore take their cues from signals given by their customers. If a customer is voluntarily willing to pay for a good at the price proposed by the entrepreneur, then the entrepreneur knows he is satisfying a want. If a customer is not willing to transact, then the entrepreneur knows he is not satisfying a want. The entrepreneur tries to anticipate customer demand, but keeps experimenting every day amid continuous changes in demand, competition, and the availability, quality, and pricing of resources. I thought that was just a terrific explanation of the entrepreneurial role in the free market. Rofer goes on to myth number 10. We need the state to provide public goods, people will say. First, because of the so-called free rider problem, namely, private firms wouldn't be able to prevent people from benefiting from these goods without paying for them. First of all, how is that a problem? People benefit from something and don't compensate others. So what? I don't see that as terrible. I don't send people invoices for my podcasts or YouTube videos, and things are okay. I don't see that as inherently a problem, people benefiting, but let's continue. Commonly cited examples of these goods include lighthouses, national defense, and police. Second, because these goods are just too difficult for the private sector to handle, they require complex arrangements or huge amounts of financial capital, and profits would be too hard to generate or would be too distant in the future. The fact that profit is hard to generate does not justify coercing people to fund your operation. Examples of these goods include roads, schools, money, courts, railroads, power, and scientific research and development. Now, all you have to do is take the lesson we learned from myth number one in Zach Rofer's excellent book here and apply these principles consistently. So imagine, well, I have the right to coerce people to give me their property because a portion of it goes towards lighthouses. And it's okay for me to take people's money by force because I run a security agency and we protect people. The fact that you go around performing actions that may or may not yield societal, quote, benefits doesn't justify you caging people who don't want to chip in to whatever you're doing. National defense, for example, is a excellent example because it makes us less safe by creating enemies all over the world by through sanctions and bombings and collusion with other governments. Courts also. I don't benefit from all the courts caging people for victimless crimes. Schools teach people to be mindless Prussian robots who obey the state and don't think critically. So I don't benefit from those. Money? Well, I'd benefit from a commodity-based money supply, whereas the current money supply is constantly diminished. I mean, that would give whoever invented Bitcoin or discovered Bitcoin the right to tax us because, well, it's hard for me to generate profits. Absolutely ridiculous nonsense. For more on this, check out The Lighthouse in Economics by Ronald H. Coase from the University of Chicago Law School, The Privatization of Roads and Highways by Dr. Walter Block, and Private Education is Good for the Poor, a study of private schools serving the poor in low-income countries by James Tooley and Pauline Dixon. As far as police and military go, and private law arbitration, check out Private Governance, Creating Order in Economic and Social Life by Edward Peter Stringham, and a collection of essays that Ed Stringham put together called Anarchy and the Law, the Political Economy of Choice. He continues on the idea of public goods, saying, why insist on a monopoly with regard to public goods? So, for example, government courts have a monopoly on enforcing law, and government police have a monopoly on enforcing said law. Even statists accept that monopolies are bad because they lead to higher prices and less innovation compared with when there is competition. If so, why would the statists argue that the state must monopolize the production of a public good? What would be the harm in allowing genuine competition? If the statist is correct, namely, that the private sector would not produce such a good, then the statist should not be concerned if the state does not outlaw competition. Note, however, that what I am advocating for is a real competition where consumers could opt out of paying for the state's public good and instead purchase only the competitive private good, he goes on. This puts these suppliers at a tremendous disadvantage since it raises the effective price to consumers of the private good because the consumers have to pay for the state's public good via taxes and then also for the supplier's public good. For the supplier's good. So if you take in Arizona, we have a private school, St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church and School, and a public school, Corona del Sol. What you would want to ask the advocate of state education is, why is it that one of these organizations gets to collect funds coercively and the other doesn't have the right to collect funds coercively? Because, I mean, things they might say about the public school is, well, you benefit from what people learn. You benefit from what people learn from St. Thomas Aquinas. Well, you live in a society, and in order to live in a society, you want kids who are educated so you can have a future of people who are intellectually able to operate in the world, and you also want people who are productive. Well, St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church and School also does that. The statist has to justify this double standard for why his organization gets to collect funds coercively and everyone else has to collect funds voluntarily. Zach Rofer continues with the free rider concept. The most fundamental point relating to public goods, however, is that statists cannot convincingly answer the question, which goods are public goods and which are not? Oftentimes, the statist's simplistic response is to cite those goods currently produced by the state. However, that is circular reasoning. The question is asking for the principles from which one could deduce which goods should be produced by the state and which should not. Just because the state is currently producing a good doesn't provide any principled argument for the necessity or morality of its production by the state. Rofer continues saying, free riders do not justify forced riders. This is a widely recognized meme called Relax, It's for the Roads, and someone coercively collecting funds to fund roads. Because if you benefit from roads and that justifies forcing people to fund them, well then anyone can force you to fund them so long as a portion of the funds go to roads or the paint for roads or flattening tar or construction companies. Rofer says, in terms of the moral issue, what the statist is saying is this. I want this good, but you benefit from it even if you don't pay for it, so I'm going to force you to pay for it. The moral counterargument is this. I don't want to. And then he actually goes on, but to me, that's enough. My body, my choice. My money, my choice. My time, my choice. He says, in terms of economics, one of the key insights of Austrian economics is that all benefits are subjective, thus it is not correct for A to tell B that B is benefiting from a so-called public good, and thus must pay for it, as in he should get caged for not chipping in. Only B can make that call. It's the equivalent of me saying, I have a YouTube channel with almost 600 videos and an Odyssey channel and library and BitChute and Minds and archive.org. You can benefit from all that stuff. And that's why I'm going to cage you if you don't give me $20 a year. I have no right to do that. Even if it's true that they do benefit, which Rofer, correctly, does not even give them the justification for, because all benefits are subjective. In practical terms, the free rider principle is capable of expanding the range of public goods to absurd levels. If a company provides a significant number of jobs in a local community, then this could provide certain benefits to that community which flow from lower unemployment, such as lower crime, greater vibrancy, etc. Yet the community is not reimbursing that company for these benefits. You also benefit from the existence of competition. Even if you only shop at store X, they know that you might go to store Y. So you benefit from the existence of businesses that you never even shop at. Same with your employer. There's a reason not all employers pay minimum wage. It's because at any time you could go somewhere else, and you have certain productive capacities. So you benefit from people you don't even know about and probably never will associate with. That doesn't give them the right to issue taxes against you or regulate your behavior. Rofer continues, myth number 21, libertarians don't care about the poor, he says on page 183. Poverty has been the default, the natural state of man for all of history. So to people like Nelson Mandela or Ayanna Pressley, Congresswoman in America, when they say, well, poverty is created, what is the cause of poverty? The answer is more or less nothing. Well, any research I do says something to the extent of Homo sapiens throughout the history of life, beginning some 4.2 billion years ago, down to recent evolution with Homo sapiens during and since the last glacial period. I also have the evolutionary process led to modern humans. Humans and their ancestors have been walking the planet for about 6 million years. Homo sapiens, who are the modern form of humans, evolved 300,000 years ago from Homo erectus. Human civilization started forming around 6,000 years ago. So even if you believe the Earth was created 6,000 years ago by God in 7 days, when was this time where there was no poverty and then a bunch of businessmen created poverty? Like, if we're in 2021 now, like 1971 or 1921, 1821, 1721, 1621, where was this non-poverty that the entrepreneur came in and ushered in? It, of course, is a lie that is just used to justify state coercion. So the idea that libertarians don't care about the poor, Rofer says, is inaccurate because they advocate an ideology referred to as free markets. This is an idea of free trade, basically. Free trade, free exchange with the recognition of self-ownership. So this, by definition, rules out slavery, coercion, theft, etc. The recognition of self-ownership thus leads us to voluntary exchange along with original appropriation, referred to as homesteading. So he says that wealth is more or less the result of specialization, also known as the division of labor, free association, people having the ability to move and go elsewhere if they're not happy with their current place of where they're purchasing things or place where they're working, and free trade, the ability to trade goods they value. With regard to the idea of businesses, Rofer says, importantly, almost every consumer-oriented business that has been successful has achieved this success through constant innovation to bring down the price of goods to make them accessible to the masses. It is much harder to achieve success on a grand scale by selling to only the rich. So we could take that principle that Rofer gives us on page 184 and apply it to the biggest examples in, let's just take American history and America currently. People like Cornelius Vanderbilt only got successful because they made both steamship travel and railroad travel available to the average Joe. Andrew Carnegie got rich by drastically lowering the price of steel. Henry Ford didn't invent the car. He increased the, he decreased the production costs of the automobile, creating Ford, giving a significant increase in access to people at lower levels of income. Walmart didn't invent food or clothes or anything else. They just increased access to people at lower income levels. Same thing with Amazon. One of the earliest videos of Jeff Bezos, you could find him saying, We started Amazon by trying to sell things like books because there's the highest quality of different types of this product. I probably should have had that quote before going into it. Either way, Amazon has done an excellent job at increasing people's access to goods they otherwise wouldn't have at lower income levels. So yeah, the kings and queens have always had access to, you know, the best things that are around. But the fact that the average Joe can just order something online and get it to their door in a short amount of time, it increases the number of options they have. If all I have is my local bookstore, I'm much less likely to understand the nature of the universe, truth, morality, philosophy, history, economics, mathematics, quantum mechanics, than if I have access to tons of other things, which places like Amazon have made accessible. And then Apple is another example where, high-tech computers, cameras, Skype, Zoom, they got wealthy because they made these things accessible to a wide number of individuals. It wasn't just pleasing the rich. So the idea that, well, we can't have a free market because then only the rich will have computers, so we need the government to nationalize computers, is just as ridiculous as, well, we can't have a free market in courts or police or military or defense because then only the rich will have military and police and defense. It's all deception. This is very in line with a thesis put forward by Deirdre McCluskey saying the two things that makes societies wealthy is 1, economic liberty, the ability to exchange both your time, labor, and property with who you'd like to voluntarily, and social honor, the idea that you are not shamed by the average person into, oh, you're seeking profit? Oh, that's evil. That's terrible. That's exploitative. This is what makes society rich. I think Rofer does an excellent job explaining this. Certainly graphics like this from humanprogress.org show us things like bicycles, blenders, coffee makers, heaters, stoves, grills, refrigerators, televisions, vacuums, microwaves, skis, treadmills, etc., stereos not only go down in price over time, but they increase in quality. This is a causal result of innovation, free trade, and competition. Not because, well, Congress made a law that blenders have to get cheaper and vacuums have to get cheaper and TVs have to get cheaper and computers have to increase in quality according to a congressional law. This is the result of voluntary exchange, innovation, free exchange of information. If you take a look at the average iPhone that someone has access to, it more or less has the capacity of a phone, a camera, a CD player, a watch, a laptop, a video recorder, and a notepad. Or as Steven Pinker says in an explanation of Enlightenment Now, he lists all the things on the right-hand side. If you're listening on the podcast, please check the description for the link to the video. You have things like Netflix, music, radio, your contact list, a flashlight, access to the New York Times, a telephone, Hulu, and tons of books and PDFs, along with many other things, in a much smaller quantity. This is also another argument for the environmentalist position of the free market. You're able to do much more with much less, which is much more friendly to the environment. A book written called Who's the Fairest of Them All? The Truth About Opportunity, Taxes, and Wealth in America, by Stephen Moore, says, here are a percentage of households and their capacity to access products in the year 1970 and in the year 2005. However, he does an interesting thing. He, in the year 1970, goes through all households, and in 2005, just looks through poor households. Using data from the Dallas Federal Reserve based on Census Bureau data, he determines that things like washing machine, clothing dryer, dishwasher, refrigerator, stove, microwave, color TV, video cassette, DVD, personal computer, telephone, cell phone, and air conditioner. More poor people in the year 2005 had access to these life-improving products than all households did in the year 1970. So not only have they gone down in price and more people can access them than previously, but they've increased in quality, vitally important. Other things Rofer goes into is the idea of charity. From mutual aid to welfare state, fraternal societies, and social services, 1890 to 1967 by David T. Beto is an excellent book. In a free society, people would be able to look up America's top charities on Forbes, and they'd be able to screenshot who they donated to so they could brag about who they are contributing to. This allows people to both increase their social status while supporting charities that help the needy. The idea that, well, charities could be corrupt, and what if they don't actually give the money to the poor? That is a legitimate concern, and that's why you need a free market in charity, because that could also happen under the existence of a state, and with a state, you can't legally opt out of funding these organizations. So that's why the free market position is morally and economically superior. It both allows you to opt out, do with your time, money, and property what you choose to do, and economically, in the sense of it provides an incentive for producers to produce things that consumers demand. It gives you the cleansing mechanism of disassociation. Rofer finishes the book with a title called Governing by principle, not arbitrarily. Rofer asks, by what standard should legislation be judged as good law in the sense of being just? He refers to the arbitrary nature of statism. This is the concept that many advocates of government are very comfortable with saying, well, X is justified because X is the law. Well, that doesn't justify the law. It's literally like me saying, it's all right for me to enslave people and kidnap them because my boss says so very clearly in his manual. Well, who justifies that manual? That's not an independent justification, Rofer says. Not so libertarians. To them, the only just law is one that prescribes the initiation or threat of force against peaceful individuals. I would also add fraud. Both of those violate the consent and mutual understanding of parties involved. Rofer says, to make this point differently, partial statism is internally inconsistent. Most statists believe in the state for some tasks and not for others, yet they can point to no consistent, cogent, logical principle which allows one to distinguish between the two sets of tasks. So this is the idea that, yeah, the state should coercively fund and monopolize police, but not healthcare. Or they should do so for healthcare, but not books. Or we should have regulation in the electronic industry, but there shouldn't be regulation in the podcast industry. If these things were morally justified, you'd be able to apply them consistently to all people and all sectors. He mentions what Tom Woods refers to as a low-intensity civil war can come arise in a society when there is not only a state, but especially a big state. So when you have in America the government stealing and printing about $5 trillion, almost a one-fourth of the economy every year, then what you have is people who otherwise would be indifferent to the actions of the state, just another organization, say, well, hey, I'm forced to fund this, so I'm going to enact my interests at the cost of yours. And if you get your way, well, then I have to succumb to your ideology and your rule. So now I want to infiltrate the state and use it to enforce my ideology on you. Probably the best examples is government education. So if the state already monopolizes education and forces you to fund and forces your kids to attend through compulsory education laws and truancy legislation, well, then you're going to want to infiltrate the state and make sure they're teaching creationism. Unless you are not a creationist, then you want them to only teach evolution. Even if you don't believe in creationism, you might say, well, I still want them to teach the ethics of the Bible and not allegiance to the state. Well, unfortunately, under statism, you only get a one-size-fits-all. Rofer continues, every interest group competes aggressively to exercise or rent the state's coercive powers, since on any issue, there can only be one winner. To use the example given previously, we either have to drink Coke or Pepsi. Rofer ends saying, to attain a more peaceful society, you need to start with a peaceful governing principle. He says that principle is the libertarian principle of self-ownership, voluntary exchange, and original appropriation. The book is Busting Myths About the State and the Libertarian Alternative by Zach Rofer. Thank you for watching. Keith Knight, don't tread on anyone.